execution of their baron. It's the enslavement of the rest of the baron's immediate family. Half of Clan Calistrate is talking open revolt against the crown, or some kind of secession of their hill from the kingdom.
And the other half? Daphna asked.
Perhaps because the queen had again fallen silent.
Fighting over the barony, of course,
Curtness said.
If Deimos Calistrate were free, he would inherit the title. If his brother were alive, he'd do the same. But they're not. So what remains is yipping and nipping at one another like hungry dogs over a scrap of meat. They're furious, but much more focused on who will be baron than on any kind of uprising.
A hiss halted any further conversation. Fela shivered behind the wall, knowing that hiss had come from the miserable thing her mother had become.
Majesty, Curtness ventured.
The Calistrates are furious, you said. And Astvik says they speak openly of rebellion.
It's only talk, my queen,
Curtness replied.
As I said, only talk. The city guard ventured onto the Seven Hills out of uniform in order to learn what is whispered among the other clans. You've just said as much. But we know there is unrest, disloyalty. And your guardsmen, Curtness, have done nothing to suppress this, and have not arrested those who foment talk of rebellion. You've listened as Quandians openly disparage their queen.
No, Majesty, Curtness said. It isn't like that.
The slap echoed even inside the walls where Fela hid. She flinched again, so startled that she did shift a bit, a tiny brush of her knee against the wall, evidence of just how deep her shock was that her mother would strike the commander of the city guard.
I wear the crown. I am queen, Lysandra said. In my veins runs the blood of the four. To speak against me is to speak against the gods themselves, to blaspheme against the four.
Would you not agree, Per Astvik? Fela held her breath. Surely, this priest of the High Order must see that magic and Spiza had not merely addled the queen's mind. They had broken it. That her judgment could no longer be trusted. Gods! The sweet and acrid stink of Spiza even permeated the walls. Fela could hear her mother inhaling noisily like a pig at the trough. This was what the great Queen Lysandra had come to. Astvik couldn't agree to.
Of course, Majesty, Astvik said. The four live through your bloodline. Those who speak against you are not only rebels, they are sinners.
There. Queen Lysandra said, almost too quietly for Fela to hear. Rebels and sinners. And if the city guard is too hesitant or too incompetent to do what must be done, then there are other ways. In the whispering space between walls, Fela felt that prickle at the back of her neck again. She flushed with excitement, sure that something remarkable was about to happen, after which nothing would ever be the same. Linos Calistrate's execution had set these events in motion, but her mother's addiction and dissolution were her own doing, and they would be her undoing.
Shom, the queen said, breaking protocol merely by acknowledging the presence of the captain of her assassins.
Tonight, you will take the Silent to Calistrate Hill and extinguish the spark of revolution. You will display the dead and make an example that will silence any disloyal tongues among the other clans. Now go, all of you. All but you, Per Astvik. There is much to discuss.
Fela heard footfalls and the creak of an opening door. She needed to go and speak with Shom before she left to do the queen's bidding. But she delayed a moment to listen, and was rewarded with a final exchange that gave her pause.
I'm going to have to tell you, Fraxia, what transpires here and among the clans, Per Astvik said.
You'll say nothing, the queen snapped. We have kept many things from your apex, Per Astvik. We both have secrets we'd rather she not know. so for now you will say nothing. There'll be time for truth later, after we have decided just what that truth ought to be.
Fila heard another huff, another sniff of Spiza, and then she whispered away in disgust. She met Shom in the alcove behind the door to the servant's stairs. The captain of the Silent stood studying a dusty carving of one of the early kings, so old now that nobody recalled which monarch it represented, so that in some ways it had come to represent them all of those who'd worn the crown and ruled in a time when there were still men and women alive who remembered the four as living gods. Legend said that Quandis had once belonged to the Bajuman, that their ancestors had been the indigenous tribe here until the clans had come with their worship of the five, who became four when the pent angel turned on the rest. That was nothing but legend, though. Folklore. Myths now known only to a few, and mostly ignored by them. Except that this dusty, forgotten king would have known better.
King Nothing had his time, Fila said quietly.
Shom turned to her, blinking in irritation. The Silent were known for their stealth, and it was good to know that Fila could still surprise her.
That's what I've always called him. In my head, Fila went on. King Nothing.
She had prowled these corridors and stairwells all her life. King Nothing's time-worn stone features were intimately familiar to her. Sometimes she had spoken to him as if he were a friend, there in the alcove at the top of the servant's stairs. But Fila had no friends today. Not even Shom.
Not even her sister, Mirren.
She searched Shom's eyes.
Is it done?
A slight knitting of the assassin's brow made Fila wonder. But then Shom gave a single slow nod, and she knew that her brother was dead. Prince Aris, no longer destined to be King Aris. Shom glanced down the servant's stairs before reaching inside her tunic and drawing out a rough cloth bag, which she handed to Fila. Its strings were not knotted, so it was the work of only a moment to open the bag and peer inside. Fila's stomach gave a sickened twist when she identified the shriveled, bloody flesh inside that bag. Her nostrils flared and her eyes welled with tears, mourning for the brother Aris had been in their childhood days. She had done this for Quandis, she told herself, for the health of the land and the glory of the four. She promised herself that, and when she glanced into Shom's eyes again, she thought perhaps the captain of the Silent was making similar vows to herself.
We do only what must be done,
Fila said quietly, though to persuade Shom or herself, she was not sure.
When you carry out my mother's orders on Calistrate Hill, make it very public. The word will travel fast. I want the Seven Hills and beyond to know that the Queen sent the Silent to exact her vengeance.
Shom nodded again, then turned and descended those darkened stairs, leaving King Nothing and the future Queen behind. Fila cinched the drawstring bag and left the alcove, moving through a doorway and back into the corridor that led to her mother's chambers. As she went, she let her grief come to the fore, let it show on her face, so that when she approached the two guards on sentry at her mother's door, they could see the pain and urgency in her. She let them see her tears.
I'm sorry, Princess Fila, one of the men said. The Queen is not to be—
Trust me,
Fila said, wiping at her tears as she shot him a withering glance.
You do not want to trifle with either one of us today.
The guards glanced at each other. The Queen's instructions regarding her privacy and her children had been inconsistent over the years, so it was no surprise that they relented. They bowed their heads to her and opened the twin doors as quietly as they could. Fila entered, padding quietly through the entrance hall and standing outside the door to the audience chamber. Inside, she could hear her mother and the priest arguing.
"Cannot take you below again,"
Per Ostvik was saying, his voice both firm and pleading.
He did not want to defy the queen, of course, but he sounded as if he had made up his mind.
But you will, Lysandra commanded. You will take me to Night Priest, or you won't live to see morning. Don't you understand that I am trying to save you, Majesty?
Her Ostvik beseeched her, clearly seeking a way out of this task.
I can feel the magic lingering in you, suffusing you in a way it could not have if you'd gone through the proper preparatory steps. It's eating your mind and destroying your body. You went too far this time, and I'm afraid—
Fila felt a momentary recollection of that taste of magic on the blood spire, leaking from her ailing mother's eyes and drawn into Fila's mouth with her gasp of surprise. Its intimacy. Its power. She knew what and where Per Ostvik spoke of when he mentioned going below, and Fila felt an intense excitement prickling at her, as if he spoke those words directly to her. But not yet, she thought. Mother rushed. I have to be careful and methodical if I'm to succeed where she has already failed. Fila entered the room. She'd thought herself prepared for the sight of her mother. But Lysandra looked worse than ever. Her ruined eye continued to weep. The smell of spiza in the room barely covered another's stench, a darkly sweet body odor that made her think of rotting things. Bent and too thin, skin hanging loosely on her frame, Queen Lysandra turned and pointed at her, jabbing the air with her finger as if it were a dart.
This conversation is not for you!
Her Ostvik said nothing, and Fila ignored her mother's anger and admonition. Instead, she allowed her grief to flow forth again as she crossed the room to hand the drawstring bag to the queen. The coarse cloth rasped on the old woman's skin as Lysandra took it in confusion.
What are you doing? What is this?
Prepare yourself, mother, Fila said. It is from Aris. That much has been confirmed. Queen Lysandra faltered. She whimpered like a wounded beast, and sorrow twisted her already ruined features into something even uglier, a contorted sculpture of human pain. Fila watched as she opened the drawstring bag and peered inside at the bloody, shrunken lumps of flesh that had been Prince Aris's manhood. The bag slipped from the queen's hands and slapped to the stone floor. Per Ostvik reached for it, but the queen turned on him, yelling, "Don't you dare!" Then she froze, as if time itself trapped her between moments, as if neither past nor future held refuge, and so she refused to move. Fila moved up beside her, put a hand on her narrow shoulder, and tried not to breathe in too deeply the sickness nesting within her. He was in bed with three Bajuman whores, Fila said. All three are dead, murdered by whoever killed him. The assassin took his body, but left his manhood behind. Queen Lysandra inhaled sharply, as if waking from a trance. She shot a dark look at Per Ostvik, who seemed to wish himself anywhere but in that room. Fila didn't blame him.
Witnesses? Lysandra asked.
Only Bajuman, but they confirm the tale. Aris is dead, mother. The prince is gone. Rumors already rise that the Bajuman are taking advantage of the confusion caused by the turmoil among the five clans to stage their own revolt. They're going to try to kill their masters. They're going to defy the crown and the four.
No,
Lysandra screamed. She kicked the coarse cloth bag and it tumbled across the floor, Prince Aris's shriveled cock and balls spilling out, leaving a trail of blood on the stones.
No, they will not.
She began screaming for the guards. Magic sparked in her eyes, misting from them, and smoking tendrils leaked from her open mouth.
There.
Fila thought, breath freezing in her chest, but she resisted the temptation to inhale, dragging the shreds of dark stuff from the air. Her mother's lips turned an ugly golden hue as she screeched. Per Ostvik approached her, perhaps trying to calm her down, but the guards rushed in and Lysandra kept screaming, and then the queen's face went slack and she began to tremble. A stain spread on the front of her dress, painting a damp wishbone on the fabric. The stink of urine overwhelmed the other odors in the room as she turned and staggered toward the small table where she'd left the small chunks of green and yellow spiza. "Majesty," Per Ostvik whispered, but he made no move to help her or touch her. His disgust had paralyzed him. Queen Lysandra collapsed, one hand still outstretched for her addiction, ignoring the trophy her son's killer had sent. Black tears ran from her ruined eye. "The Bajuman," she said to the city guards as they approached her. "Tell Commander Curtness to kill them. Send him to me if he wants the order from my mouth, but kill them. Kill them all." And Fila's hands deftly shifted the cards a little more. Admiral Daria Halardi breathed deeply, and the smell of wood smoke, sulfur, and burning flesh filled her nose. The battle had been over for an hour, but her blood was still up, and her breathing was short and harsh. With one pirate ship sunk and the second set aflame, the outcome was not a surprise to her at all. She had killed two pirates with her own hand, and that did not trouble her. What did disturb her was the message that had arrived by Seagull from the Queen, commanding all ships not engaged in vital defense of the kingdom to return to the capital, to put down with a message called a simmering insurgence. Even though Daria had already made her decision about how to respond, uncertainties bit at her, and she was not used to that. Daria had come as far as she had because she was decisive and firm. She did not like harboring doubts. It made her feel like a Bajuman. She looked from the windows at the rear of her wardroom. The burning pirate ship was half a mile astern, its rigging and masts now little more than stark lines against the flames reaching ever higher. It was listing to starboard, and soon the sea would rush in, extinguish the flames, and claim the ship for its own. Out of two pirate crews, there were only 5 survivors, and now it was time to interrogate them. They waited, tied up on the deck of the Nyadine, the finest vessel in the Crown's fleet. They knew that their time was short. She would promise them a quick, painless death if they answered her questions, but the task did not fill Daria with glee, because she had questioned pirates before. It was very unlikely that they would talk. It was highly probable that they would die in terrible agony rather than betray any secrets about the pirate guilds. Still, she had to try. The way the Nyadine rolled and creaked felt familiar and reliable to her, but the boards breathed with the ghosts of sailors past, and she felt them with her, from captain down to deckhand. The men and women who had rigged the sails and plied the waters on this ship would not judge her. They had fulfilled their duty and expected nothing but the same from her. Which begged the question, what was her duty today? She had never been very good at trusting people. Most of the officers in her command had earned the faith she put in them. But it was one thing to trust your subordinates to follow orders and to be competent, and another thing entirely to rely upon the wisdom and counsel of another. She trusted Shar to be loyal and brave, but in the end he was merely her steward and hadn't the breadth of life's experience to offer real perspective. For the past 2 years, whenever she had a difficult decision to make, Daria had relied on the counsel of one man, Demos Calistrate. She could never share the core truth of her life with him, or with anyone. But her doubts and fears, her hesitations when it came to decisions regarding her command, were things that she could trust Demos with. And something like this order from the Queen. "Fore curse you, Demos," she thought. "You had to be on leave now? Of all times?" When he returned from leave, Demos would be given the captaincy of the Breath of Tikra, the oldest ship in her fleet of 6. If Daria didn't think it would cause a mutiny, she'd have given him Captain Gree's job. Her sailors loved and admired Deimos, but he had been with them too short a time to be raised above so many far more experienced women and men. Unless I arrived back in the capital while he was still on leave, she thought. Wouldn't that surprise him? A knock on the door did not make her turn. She knew that knock, its scuffle, and knew Char would come in whether or not she bade him enter.
Captain Gree has gathered everyone on deck, Char said. The prisoners are still aggressive and defiant. One of them has already killed herself.
How? Daria asked. I ordered that they were to be bound and kept alive for questioning.
And bound they are, Char said. Best guess, she had a capsule of redfish venom somewhere in her mouth.
Daria raised her eyebrows. She'd seen someone die of a redfish bite. She'd choose that over a quick death?
She's still smoking, Char said.
Such dangerous enemies we have to fight.
Which makes the decision about the Queen's order a real dilemma, Admiral?
Char asked. More than you know, Daria said quietly.
But we'll go, surely,
Char replied, coming to stand at her elbow, where he placed himself so often in hopes of being useful.
The message carried by that gull made it plain there is strife at home. The Queen
has instructed her army to send whatever forces we can spare without interfering with our existing missions, Daria interjected. She did not need to remind Char that he ought not to question her. Her tone said enough. I'd much rather be out across the sea, attempting to find the far shore, or to re-establish relations with the Chilkat people. But our orders to confront the pirate threat brought us closer to home, and this mission is vital.
It's pirate raiding parties, Admiral. Nothing more. The islands around the ring have fought off pirates before, and they will again, with or without our help.
You're young, Char. You see the current threat, but you're not good at looking forward. If these pirate guilds ever banded together, they could pose a threat not just to the ring but to all of Qantas. Now this dog who claims to be Carod the Red, who has been dead for 5 centuries, Char interrupted. I'm not suggesting he is actually Carod the Red, but whoever this new pirate chief is, he knows how to inspire the guilds, which is why we can't return to Lartha. We've still work to do here, and questioning the captives, getting every ounce of information we can from them, is only the beginning. The Queen will have to get along without us. Char nodded grimly, as if all the wisdom of the ages weighed upon his head.
So you've decided.
I have. Daria would tell the captains what she had told Char. Like him, they would accept her reasoning. The logic was sound, after all. If this new pirate chief who fancied himself a figure out of legend managed to persuade the various guilds to band together, they might turn themselves into an effective army of thieves and cutthroats, and the Quandian Navy could not allow that. In the name of the Crown, they had to track down and destroy this new Carod the Red.
Some of the captains will balk, Char said. There are some among them who will want to rush to the Queen, out of loyalty or seeking glory.
You mean Captain Gree? A flicker of a smile crossed Daria's face. Char disapproved of anyone he thought might not be completely dedicated to her. Given the life she'd been born into, she didn't like comparing a person to an animal, but he did have a singular loyalty she'd only ever seen in dogs. She was grateful for the fierceness of his friendship.
Perhaps.
I know how to handle Gree, she said. That's why I'm an admiral. She smoothed the front of her jacket, ensuring that her sword and throwing stars were secure in their sheaths. She might be using them again soon. Daria led by example, even more so if that meant interrogation and torture. It was yet another reason that she was held in such high esteem. Though an admiral, she was not afraid to get her hands bloody. Up on deck, the stench of battle was even stronger. The bodies of 7 Quandians killed in the skirmish were being washed and prepared for a sea burial on the foredeck. Their wounds sewn and bound, fine clothing laid out ready for dressing. Soon they would be lowered into the hands of Daphine, god of water and beasts.
It was a sad accompaniment to the scene immediately before her. The 5 pirate captives were lashed to the railings amidships. One of them, a woman, was scorched lobster red by the redfish venom she'd managed to swallow, and a pool of blood still bubbled on the deck around her. Hair hung low over her face, obscuring much of the dreadful damage from view. Her arms were stretched out to either side. The rope securing her to the railings smoked. Daria was glad her corpse had been left among her companions. They could smell the sweet cooked meat stench of her death, and 2 of them were even now trying to move themselves aside from her spilled blood. If it touched their skin, it would burn. She walked slowly along the line, pausing before the dead woman, drawing her sword, and using its tip to lift the corpse's head so that all could see her disfigured face. Some of her own people looked away. None of the pirates did. "This could be you," she said.
"We'd welcome it,"
one of the pirates said. He was a big man, heavily tattooed, serpents and suckered sea creatures squirming along his limbs, from beneath his sleeves and short trouser legs. A sea dragon twisting around his neck and across his face. Its open mouth sat around his own. When he spoke, the dragon roared. "Your name?" Daria said.
"Phillips. I knew a Quandian like you once, only not as ugly. I took out her eyes and ate them while I skull-fucked her. She was still alive. She lived for a few days after that and the rest of my crew."
Daria flicked her sword and sliced it across his cheeks and through his nose. His cheeks fell open, blood bubbling around the split in his nose as he tried to calm his breathing. At least it had stopped his foul words. "I'll kill you all quickly if you answer my questions," she said.
"Where's the honor in a quick death?"
Phillips asked, spitting blood.
"Give me hours. Give me days."
He stared right at her as he shuffled sideways, laying his leg flat in his dead companion's toxic blood. His skin began to sizzle. Phillips grinned. "I'll have your leader on my sword before the summer's out," Daria said.
"Karov the Red has been on many swords,"
Phillips shouted. The pain seemed to be feeding him, fueling his anger and fury.
"King Karov will eat you all. He'll chew you up and—"
Daria turned her back on the pirates and faced her crew and captain. Gree was smiling, and his smile widened as they locked eyes. She knew that her decision to remain at sea, rather than sailing for Quandis, was not his favored one. But she could also see that he understood her reasoning. Having Captain Gree maintain his trust in her gave Daria strength. She knew that she was going to need it. Incensed by her turning her back on him, Phillips the pirate ranted and shouted some more, all to no avail. She waited until his ravings quieted, then turned around to continue her questioning. She had prepared herself for this. It would be a long, bloody afternoon. The heavy beating of wings interrupted her. A huge albatross appeared from around the ship's bow, circling the Nyadine once before drifting down to land on the railing, tucking in its enormous wings. The symbol of Clan Dochlan was painted in blue upon its proud chest, and the bird cocked its head and stared at Daria and her crew. The gull that had arrived earlier still was exhausted and waiting for a return message. Gulls were typically used to deliver messages within the confines of Quandis, or sometimes as far out as the ring, so when one arrived this far from home, Daria knew that there were only 2 explanations. Either whoever had sent that message had been an amateur, or all the Crown's albatrosses had already been employed. This new arrival was not from the Crown at all. Clan Dochlan were foreign traders, merchants, and explorers. And so they had many albatrosses of their own. Using one to send a message to one of Quandis's military vessels was unheard of. Shar started toward the bird, but Daria held up a hand.
"No, I'll get it."
The moment she approached, the albatross froze. It stood patiently as she reached out,
unwrapped the leather covering on its left leg, and peeled away the heavy parchment rolled within. It was addressed directly to her. Daria unfurled the parchment and stood staring at the words scrawled there, her pulse quickening.
Baron Calistrate executed. Family enslaved. If you come home, do not speak of your friend and my son, Deimos, or you risk yourself. With respect and in mourning, Karina Calistrate.
Daria stood still for a few beats of her heart, blinking away the shock. Then she held the parchment up and let it go, watching it catch a breeze and drift up, then down into the waves. She turned toward her crew who waited expectantly. Captain Gree was frowning.
Char, kill that bird and take it to the cook. The captains and I will have it for dinner.
Yes, Admiral, of course.
Char eyed the big bird, its vicious beak and heavy wings, and rested his hand on his knife. Daria hefted her sword. She started with the pirate closest to her, slicing his throat and stepping back so that the blood did not spurt onto her boots. She moved down the line, and when she reached Phillips, he was grinning at her, head back to expose his neck.
"Hail King Carol the Red," he said.
"Yes, I'm sure." She stabbed him through the heart, then turned to face her shocked crew once again. "Captain Gree, send signals to summon the other captains to the stateroom. Prepare the fleet. We're done here. We're sailing for Qantas." As she went below decks, Daria's loyalties fought within her. Sailing for Qantas, yes, and into a time of turmoil and mystery. But who she might serve when she arrived was a question yet to contemplate. Phila had mastered the art of being still, yet she despised the act when it was forced upon her. She sat now in a furrowwood chair, its seat and backing so rigid that such chairs were most often used by the priesthood. They found something like grace in their own discomfort. Phila had always disparaged this foolishness, and yet wasn't she doing something quite like that tonight? This very moment? Who is the fool now? She thought. The thing that lay in her mother's bed did not resemble Queen Lysandra. Withered, arms folded defensively around her chest. Her mother was curled on her side, dragging in quick, shallow breaths, as if each one were precious to her. And perhaps they were. Only her ruined eye remained visible, the other buried in the pillow beneath her head. Her hair had gone thin and waxy and fallen out in hanks. Tears still wept from the ruined eye, but the wondrous magic that had snaked from within her to be whipped away on the breeze had given way to a thick yellow pus.
"Majesty," said Daphna the voice, shifting on the end of the bed, perhaps under the illusion that the queen still needed her.
"Can I get you anything?"
"Hush, fool," Phila said. "Don't you see she's beyond needing things this world can provide?"
Daphna glanced at her, stung. Phila ignored Daphna's hurt feelings and grief, wondering what might become of her now. She supposed she would have to endure the woman for a little while, so that the transition of power seemed respectful. Peaceful. Daphna might even prove useful in the long term. The people had faith in her, and she did have an uncanny ability to project calm, even when delivering dreadful news. It might be worth keeping her around. She would think on it. Standing sentry at the head of the bed, Shom watched over Queen Lysandra and barely lifted her eyes toward Princess Phila or Daphna. Her loyalty remained invested in the crown itself, not the woman wearing it, and her obligation tonight was to her current monarch. She watched over Lysandra with a looming, monolithic devotion. A breeze eddied along the floor, and Phila relished it. Before she had stopped speaking entirely, the queen had asked for the room to be warmer, and so Daphna had instructed the servants to bank the unseen fires higher and to vent the heat into the queen's chambers. It was insufferable. The breeze was a relief then,
and moreover meant that another mourner had arrived. Mirin entered the room. She moved with a grace and power that Fila admired, quiet out of respect rather than a desire for stealth. The Princess Mirin hated their mother now. She must, Fila reasoned, given the fate of the Calistrates. But still she behaved as if grief had her in its grip. Fila did not rise from her chair. Daphna slipped off the end of the queen's bed and retreated to the archway around a recessed window, as if she wished to vanish there. Mirin knelt at the queen's bedside, staring at the wreckage of the woman who had raised them with a stern hand, profound expectations, and cold wisdom, when she had bothered to raise her daughters at all. Aris had been her golden child. "Is that?" Mirin began, then turned to look at her sister. "Do I smell Spiza, Fila?" She begged the healers. They relented. "If that's what brings her peace." Fila shrugged. Mirin nodded. "No harm in it now, I suppose. We all know her bonnie's more than familiar with it," Fila said bitterly, surprising herself. Quite undisciplined of her to allow her true feelings to show. That wouldn't do at all. Mirin bent and whispered something to their mother. For several minutes they remained like that, all of them as silent as Shom. Only the breathing of the heat vents and the queen's ragged exhalations breaking the quiet. And then Mirin glanced at her older sister again. "Where is Aris? It's unthinkable that he should be anywhere but here." Fila let her gaze drift to Shom before focusing on Mirin once more.
"Mirin, our brother is dead."
Mirin had been kneeling, but now she sagged to one side, gripping her mother's bedclothes. Sitting on the floor, back to the bed, she stared at Fila.
"Take that back. Say it's not true."
From the window archway, not as hidden as she'd like, Daphna spoke up.
"I'm afraid it is. Prince Aris has been murdered by Bajuman. An edict has been issued by the queen to execute them all to be sure that his killers will die."
Mirin hung her head.
"It makes no sense. Why would they—"
"Perhaps they were tired of him fucking their women," Fila said. 3 Bajuman whores were murdered with him, all in the same bed."
"No," Mirin said, squeezing her eyes shut. "How can this be happening?"
Fila frowned.
"You act as if you loved our brother. Aris was horrible to you."
Lysandra moaned softly. Daphna emerged from her redoubt, eyes hopeful.
"Majesty?" "Leave us,"
Fila said without turning toward the voice. The room held its breath. Fila kept her gaze on her sister, but she could practically hear the voice stiffening.
"You do not command me," Daphna said.
Such temerity, Fila thought. She glanced at Shom, who moved instantly out from behind the queen's bed and stood staring at the voice of the queen. Fila had to give her that. Daphna had spine, for she stood facing Shom as if fear had not begun to chill her bones. Mirin watched it all happen, and a light of epiphany flickered across her face. She rose shakily to her feet.
"It would seem that she does, Daphna,"
Princess Mirin said, smoothing her coat. "Based on my mother's condition, it seems unlikely she will linger more than a few days at best. The healers tell me they have no experience with whatever ails her and cannot forecast her fate with any certainty, but look at her, Daphna." Mirin herself did as she instructed the other woman, turning to face the queen.
"My mother is dying. My brother has been murdered. Perhaps Princess Fila does not command you today, but she will be Queen Fila soon enough. Yet if nothing else, respect a daughter's wish to be alone with her dying mother."
The voice did not speak again, but quietly retreated from the queen's chambers. A cool breeze danced along the floor, and then there came the soft thunk of the doors closing in the anteroom. At last, Fila rose from the chair. Heart quickening, she stood beside Mirin, and the two princesses looked down upon the ruined shell of their mother. Fila remembered callousness in her childhood, but there were kindnesses as well. There had been laughter, even honor once upon a time. She had learned vital lessons from Lysandra when she'd been just a girl. If that woman had lived on, strong and wise and ruthless, Fila would never have desired the crown. At least that was what she told herself. But the blood of the four ran in their veins, and the crown deserved more than the selfishness and corruption that had replaced Lysandra's better traits. Quandis deserved a queen willing to do anything to maintain its grandeur and honor, to restore both the fear and the faith of the people. She would be that queen, and that brief taste of magic on the blood spire had shown her how. Their island state shone brightly, an example to the world. Other nations wished to trade with her, or go to war with her, or desired her protection. The four had smiled upon this place, had carved it from the land with their own hands, planting their seed in its people so that the crown would always rest on the head of one of their own descendants. Fila knew she was doing what must be done. Yet it hurt her just the same. For the first time in years, she took her sister's hand. Mirin glanced down at her. "This will be better for Quandis," she said, as if reading Fila's mind. "We both know that. Her mind has been unraveling." Fila studied her, wondering just how perceptive her sister might be. "It was never my dream to be queen." Mirin's gaze flickered toward Shom, but only for a moment. "Until it was." Swallowing down a smile, Fila gave the tiniest nod. "Until it was. When you're queen, you'll undo the horrors of these past weeks. You'll order the Callistrates released." "Order Deimos released, you mean? Does that mean you've learned who purchased him? Euphraxia has him, the Apex," Fila said, interest flaring. "Why would she? His mother is enslaved to Clan Docklin, and his brother is dead." Mirin finished. Fila nodded, understanding immediately. Docklin and Callistrate had been allies for many generations. It seemed likely Corina Callistrate had been purchased by their old friends in order to save her from suffering at other hands, which could only mean that Euphraxia had outbid them for Deimos. A strange turn indeed, unless one considered history. "You must order them both freed immediately," Mirin said. "We can't bring Deimos's father or brother back, but you can at least give him and his mother freedom." On the bed, Lysandra sighed and shuddered, almost as if she could hear their conversation, and it revolted and infuriated her. Fila thought perhaps she could, and didn't mind. She smiled and turned to her sister. "I know you're good with a sword, but I always wondered if you'd have the stomach for actual combat." "Now I think perhaps you would. It seems you have a stiffer spine than I've given you credit for. I'm proud of you." Mirin squeezed Fila's hand. "You'll do it then. You have my word, I will try." "Try? Euphraxia is the Apex, and I suspect she has," Fila shrugged, "a peculiar hunger to make Deimos her slave. But why?" "I've heard rumors of an old grudge," Fila said. As usual, she did not let on any more than was required. In her whispering, she had heard fragments of conversations, and putting them together, she constructed an incomplete picture of Euphraxia's hatred of the Callistrate name. But this news seemed to confirm it all. Sometime long ago, long before most alive now were even born, save perhaps Per Ristolo and some others of the High Order, whose advanced ages even she did not know for certain, Euphraxia's family had been part of Clan Callistrate. The tale involved a Callistrate ancestor who had ruined Euphraxia's former family name. The exact nature of this offense Fila still did not know, but it was enough to cause the family to be banished from the clan. Euphraxia's ancestors, and consequently Euphraxia herself, had been encouraged to join the priesthood to make ends meet. The whole event had inspired a deep-seated hatred that persisted down through the generations and must still burn bright and hot in Euphraxia's heart today. Phila wondered how well this intense hatred sat beside the Apex's worship and love of the Four, gods of fairness, forgiveness, and mercy.
Grudge or no grudge, you have to try, Mirin said.
I'll do my best to release them, Phila said thoughtfully, pieces falling together in her mind. But not immediately. First, there is something Deimos must do for me.
Suspicion clouded Mirin's eyes.
What is it you want, sister? So Phila told her, in detail. Mirin protested at first, but eventually she relented as Phila knew she would.
What choice did she have?
Extracting a promise to be kept apprised of their mother's condition, Mirin glared at her sister one last time, and then hurried from the queen's chambers. Running to Deimos, no doubt.
Now, Shom, Phila said when she was certain Mirin had gone. It's time we eased Queen Lysandra's burden. There is much to be done, and Quandis won't benefit from a long, uncertain wait. There's no need for my mother to suffer anymore.
The captain of the Silent might have been carved of stone for all that her expression gave away in that moment. But when Phila went to the hutch where the healers had secreted the queen's spiza inside tiny drawers, when she brought it back and began to administer the spiza to her mother's lips, Shom gave her assent simply by remaining still. Soon, Queen Lysandra was also still, also silent, and so she would remain forever.
Chapter 7
The novices of Yaris Teague were walking in pairs through the bustling Larthen streets and squares north of Temple Hill. Ahead of them, across a wide, shallow valley, loomed the hill of Clan Dochlan, its sheer eastern cliff evidence of some ancient cataclysm that must have split the hill in half, all the other slopes heavily built up with colorfully rendered structures. Homes, shops, restaurants, storage buildings, schools, and its renowned hospital. At its top was the sprawling castle housing the greater families of the clan, and its wider network of friends and advisors. Down at the base of the hill, lining the bank of the River Susk, where it cut through the city, were the offices, warehouses, jetties, and docks used by Clan Dochlan to marshal and organize their extensive trade operations. Several large ships were moored, and countless smaller vessels came and went up and down the river, many of them docking beside the trading clan's hill. Business was done, money changed hands, promises were made, and deals forged. It was so different from the quiet of the temple. Away from their quiet studies, the novices were told they could look, but never speak. These times outside Yaris Teague were part of their initiation into the priesthood, because it involved levels of self-control and adherence to their teacher's strict instructions. Jemmy was failing her test.
"See the way they're looking at you?" she whispered.
Blaine frowned and glanced sidelong at his friend.
"All around," she continued. "Mothers with children, traders at their stalls, teenagers and soldiers. They're looking at you as I've learned to. Quiet," he urged. "Per Santiger will hear and we'll be—
They're looking at you not as a Bajuman, but as a priest." Blaine drew in a sharp breath. His anger at Jemmy simmered away to nothing, and he wanted instead to reach across and grasp her hand. He didn't, of course, but he still marveled at the idea that she was a friend. It was taking him some time to grow accustomed to the fact that he had a friend with brown eyes. Most Bajuman never had the chance to entertain such friendships, other than during the innocence of childhood, and his own reaction to it was unexpected. For a man so focused on his own separate purpose, he felt deeply touched and moved by something as simple as Jemmy's smiles.
That's because we are priests first and foremost, Per Santiger said.
Blaine flinched, waiting to be berated. Beside him, Jemmy pursed her lips into a tight smile. But Per Santiger, walking close behind them, did not tell them off.
If you know deep inside that you serve the Four, then however damaged your soul, however set upon, abused, mistreated, or twisted by guilt, the love of the Four will repair it. They will reforge it with a passion and drive to serve them. That's why they look at you as a priest, Blaine, even if they glimpse your brand or your eyes. Because you're starting to believe it yourself.
The old priest's words startled Blaine, but he nodded his thanks.
Now, as I recall, my instruction was that we should walk in silence,
Per Santiger said, and he hurried past them, huge girth swaying, to the head of the line of 20 novices. Blaine glanced at Jemmy, and when she smiled, he could not hold back his smile in return. It was honest and heartfelt, and he let himself enjoy the moment. With that newfound confidence, he let himself look for the first time at the many Larthans in the streets and squares they passed through. It was a stance he was not used to. Usually, as a Bajuman, he walked with his head bowed, averting his eyes from others in case their gazes accidentally locked. If that happened, some would choose to beat him for his audacity, while others might simply shout in rage. Not everyone hated the Bajuman from birth, but tradition was a powerful force. So powerful, apparently, that the simple tradition of the priesthood was enough to overcome generations of bigotry and intolerance. They passed into a warren of narrow streets, high buildings shutting out the view of the Temple of Four, and associated smaller temples behind them, and the gently sloping route down to the river in front. Per Santiger hadn't revealed their destination, but that was not his way. For him, every walk was a journey, every day a new adventure, and he lectured that moving closer to the Four meant identifying and embracing opportunities to learn more about those ancient gods. Their time at Yarris Teague was all about discovering these opportunities, and Per Santiger's way was often to let realization dawn, rather than try to force it upon them. The streets were relatively quiet. These were residential districts, and many people were either away from their homes at work or school, or sleeping off a night's activities. Those they did pass were women, young children, and old people, and almost all of them performed the sign of Four as the trainee priests and their tutor walked by. Blaine looked at an attractive woman and glanced away, but not before he caught her smile. He looked up again. She was still looking at him, holding her hand to her throat in the sign of Four. She held the hand of a small child, a young boy picking his nose and watching this strange procession with wide eyes. Blaine smiled back and continued on his way. 50 days ago, he might have been arrested and flogged for such a smile. They passed through several more narrow streets, until he could start to taste the unmistakable hint of the river Susk, the mix of salt water and silt the great river carried up from the sea and back down from the uplands twice each day. He liked the river. It reminded him of his mother, and the time she had taken him and his sister there to bathe when their day's work was done. The land has a long history and a deep memory, and the ebb and flow of these waters is like its heartbeat, she would say. Strip, bathe, wash, and feel its pulse.
It's the salt baths, Jemmy whispered.
What?
That's where he's taking us.
What are the salt baths?
Didn't you ever?
She trailed off. She no longer got embarrassed when she forgot his ancestry.
No, of course he didn't. You'll see, fed by the river, heated from deep vents in the caves below, lit by burning sky moss permanently aflame on the ceilings. It's quite a place.
Why would we be going there? Jemmy's sidelong smile turned into a grin.
To sing.
During Blaine's time training for the priesthood, Jemmy's love of singing had quickly become apparent. She was good at it, and the first time they sang together with other priests, he realized that she reveled in it, too. She loved it so much that she'd expressed disappointment that Linos Callistrate's execution had been so abrupt that they'd never gotten to sing the mournful quell. Blaine's look of shock had drawn a contrite apology from her, but he still wondered whether it was heartfelt. Blaine was tone-deaf and didn't know most of the songs they sang, yet he was grudgingly starting to enjoy it. There was something about opening your lungs and singing to the sun, moon, and stars that felt like freedom. At the edge of a larger square, Per Santiger paused at the head of their column and turned to address them. Past the priests in front of him, Blaine could see across the square to a tall, elaborate facade that he had never given a second glance before. He'd known it was used for something he would never be able to experience, so he had closed it off from his mind. It was simply a weighty shadow casting down on him just as his eyes were cast to the ground. Now he saw it properly, and he realized what a beautiful structure it was. Cornered with pillars, faced with colored timber paneling carved and painted into scenes from histories that Blaine could only guess at. The river shushed by behind the building, and a shimmering haze rose from six tall chimneys extending 30 feet above the high domed roof.
"Today, I have brought you to the..."
Per Santiger began, but then a commotion across the square caught everyone's attention. Blaine shifted sideways to see past those in front of him. A squad of city guards emerged from behind the salt baths building. There were at least a dozen of them, heavily armed and armored. And between them they were dragging six frightened, scrawny slaves. All Bajumen. None of them struggled. They knew better than that. The squad's captain strode to the center of the square, a group of small children scattering before him, their mothers or nannies scooping them up into their arms and backing away to the square's edges. The sun beat down and larks still sang as they danced above the city, capturing insects from the air. But the atmosphere had changed. Something dark and cool settled around the square, like invisible shadows anticipating night. "What's happening?" Blaine asked. Per Santiger did not turn around to reprimand him. Other trainee priests were also chattering.
"They use slaves to shovel the salt up from mesh collection grids on the riverbanks," Jemmy said. "I wonder why."
The captain drew his sword and planted it point down in the pavers at his feet. As the six Bajumen were thrown to their knees in a line 10 paces behind him, the captain addressed the crowd.
"For crimes against the state," he said.
His voice sounded relaxed, not agitated. It was the voice of a man who had already said these words before, perhaps many times that day. And for the first time, Blaine noticed something else about this contingent of the city guard. Blood smeared their armor, dulling the usual shine. Their hair hung in sweaty bunches as if they had been exerting themselves or running. And the captain carried a looped wire ring hanging from his belt. Blaine couldn't be sure what the things threaded onto this wire were, not from this far away, but he thought they looked fleshy, pale.
"And for crimes against our queen, and against the four, and against—"
He waved a hand as if at a fly buzzing his face. He sounded almost bored.
"Their sentence is death."
At that final word, six city guards drew their own swords and slashed them through the air. Blaine would never forget that moment. It happened in the blink of an eye, but something slowed it in his perception, as if the hot summer air was too heavy to allow such movement, too oppressive to entertain such rapid, sudden violence. The swords sang the same notes as they connected with the Bajumen's necks. Four heads spun and rolled, hitting the ground and spilling blood. Gasps went up from some of those spectators who had retreated to the edges of the square. Jemmy grasped Blaine's hand, but it was him who squeezed.
Anyone owning a Bajamin slave is to submit them to the guard for judgment,
the captain said as the bodies fell.